I'm back in the saddle again, out where a friend is a friend, where the longhorn cattle feed on the lowly jimson weed. I'm back in the saddle again, riding the range once more, toting my old 44, where you sleep out every night and the only law is right. Back in the saddle again. Whoopee-tie-i-o, rocking to and fro. Back in the saddle again. Whoopee-tie-i-ay, I go my way. Back in the saddle again. I'm back in the saddle again, out where a friend is a friend, where the longhorn cattle feed on the lowly jimson weed. I'm back in the saddle again, riding the range once more, toting my old 44. Where you sleep out every night, and the only law is right.
Well, there he is, boys. We're back in the saddle again. We is back in the saddle again, and this is your not the Lone Ranger, not the Durango Kid, not Whip Wilson, not Tex Ritter, not, Rex Allen, not Hopalong Cassidy, I know a whole bunch more, but I can't remember them right this moment. It is Terrible Tommy in the Bunker, and it is I thought this was going to be the 1st of April. No, this is the 31st of March, the last day. March the 31st, 2014, Moon's Name. Tommy's back in the saddle. You can probably tell by my voice. My voice is not all the way back in the saddle, but I think we'll make it through the show, okay? I got some interesting things that I've... sound bites that I'm going to play for you today. Interesting things I picked up in over my recuperation spell there. Let's get into some of it. I heard the head of the FBI was talking this morning. Let's see if I could find what he was saying.
Most importantly, counterterrorism.
It remains our number one priority. In 8 years out of government, I discovered as I came back that the threat from terrorism had metastasized in ways that I had not understood until I took this job. What I mean by metastasis is we've had great success against core al-Qaeda, sort of the primary tumor in this challenge, and reduced it thanks in large part to the work of the men and women in uniform and in our intelligence services. But at the same time, the poorly governed or lightly governed spaces around the world have allowed a growth of a metastasizing tumor in places like the Arabian Peninsula and around North Africa and other places around the Mediterranean. And so we face a threat that is weaker in the core, but disparate and virulent in a lot of different places. We also face a new threat that was not on the front of my screen when I was Deputy Attorney General 8 years ago, and that is the people we call homegrown violent extremists. I don't like the term lone wolf because it conveys a dignity that these characters don't deserve. But these are the people who, thanks to the ready availability of information on the internet, can be inspired, even if not directed by al-Qaeda, and can be in their basement convincing themselves they need to engage in some jihad and kill Americans. and they emerge from that basement with very little time for us to find them and to stop them. So counterterrorism in those many different ways remains our number one priority for reasons that make good sense to me. Second, counterintelligence remains a top priority of the FBI because the enemies of this country are every bit as aggressive trying to steal our secrets as they were when I last left government and have many more ways to do it, again, thanks to the proliferation of the Internet and the vulnerabilities we face in cyberspace. And I mentioned cyber. It touches everything that I do, everything the FBI is responsible for reasons that make sense to me. We as a country and as individuals have connected our entire lives to the Internet. It's where our secrets are, it's where our infrastructure is, it's where our children play, it's where our money is, it's where our health care is. So that's where bad people come for our children, for our money, for our private information, for our state secrets, for our key infrastructure. It cuts across everything I'm responsible for. And so one of the FBI's missions is to make sure that our workforce is trained, deployed, and equipped to respond to that threat, which touches our counterterrorism, our counterintelligence, and all of our criminal responsibilities. And with respect to criminal, there's no doubt there's terrific news over the last decade, and that is that crime is dropping in the United States, but there remains far too much abuse of children, human trafficking, gangs dominating neighborhoods, far too much in the way of fraudsters and tricksters stealing money of all sorts, far too much public corruption.
Well, just another lawyer figurehead of the FBI. Now they got, I forget what he said, 60 offices around the world or 600 offices? Unbelievable. And he was pushing the fact they're hiring 1,000 more, and they want to hire a lot more than that. New agents and people working for the FBI, you know. Now you got this giant army, which was never meant to be the size it is, the way it is, and certainly not meant to be international. Then you got the CIA, then you got the DEA. Incidentally, the new Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, which is about the DEA, pictures them pretty much the way they are from the ones I knew. And the ones that came to my house, these were a little more radical than those guys that came to my house. But the DEA hires a hell of a lot of people who they've arrested. And I knew two guys that was in the Klan, in my Klan in California, and I think I've told you this before, that unbeknownst to me were dealing. And they got busted, and I ran into one of them one time. I don't know under what occasion that was, but he told me they let him off. He didn't go to jail, and they put him right in the DEA as an informant or a contract agent or something. I knew two guys like that that got totally out of dealing. Didn't do any time and went right to work for the DEA. Anyhow, that new movie with Schwarzenegger's pretty good movie if you like action movie. If you like to see how cowboy DEA people operate, well, that's a movie to watch. Yes, it is. And I must say, Schwarzenegger's acting is getting a little better. Yeah, it's getting a little better. Following is about a book that's been written by this lady. It goes back into the crimes of the FBI and the COINTELPRO program, which I'm well familiar with, that was very active during my early days in this struggle. And this starts out with a FBI break-in that they performed in Washington. I believe it was in Washington, D.C.
But they know anything, and what's the consensus in the room? And pretty soon everybody started nodding, okay, let's go ahead. So the people agreed that without that very calm center, with the news that Keith had, they would have called off the burglary. As it was, Keith went back and with a crowbar this time, in addition to his lockpicking tools.
What time... Well, first of all, how long did they plan the raid?
I mean, how long a period of time?
Yes.
From they assembled first in late December, chose their name, and then they started in early January to case and to plan. And one of the first things they did was choose the night, which was a very special night. When they started talking about it, you know, it seems as though no one night is better than any other night. But one of them said, there's a big prize fight coming up, world championship. First time that Muhammad Ali will be in the ring after being out, I think, for 5 years by then because of his conviction in refusing to serve in the military. So it was the night of the world champion fight between Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier. And they thought, rightly it turned out, it would be in the office, although they had never seen anyone in there after 5 o'clock during their casing. But perhaps this was more important, two other elements. They thought that no local police people would be patrolling that night because they would be listening to the fight. And that seemed to turn out to be true. But also...
Now, this break-in actually was the anti-war people that were successful in breaking into an FBI office and stealing every file they had.
It was on the second floor, and the two stories above were residential apartments. The hallway that was open, anyone could have come down and seen what was happening outside the doors he was breaking in at any time. So they thought again that the noise from the fight, if everybody was tuned in, might muffle any kind of burglary noises that took place.
We just showed the picture that you took of the building. How much of that building were you able to see when you visited?
Well, you were able to walk in and go to any floor. It was.
I mean, you go to the building
years later
when you were stuck. Yeah,
years later.
And
yeah.
Then what is in there now?
Oh, assorted business offices, law offices, real estate offices.
How many people worked there for the FBI at the time?
Five. It was a five-man office. I think there were three rooms, either three or four rooms.
How much actual material did they, when they did the raid, did they take away?
They took every file in the office. It was done in the dark. They had no way of knowing what they had. I mean, this is one of the most interesting aspects of the burglary itself. They decided to take this risk, not having any idea whether they'd find anything of value. I mean, for all they knew, they were taking out personnel forms.
If you stacked up, what would it have been? Any way to describe that?
Well, it was a files that they removed. Filled each of the four people who went inside took two large-sized suitcases. And they were filled, but one of those suitcases also had a briefcase that they had quickly taken and put in a suitcase.
What time of day did they do this?
They did it considerably later than they intended to. They intended to do it somewhere between 8 and 8:30, and they thought that the fight would start then, and it didn't. I mean, the preliminaries of the fight were taking place. So as it turned out, the delay that Keith had in getting in matched the late start of the fight, which didn't start until I think it was 10:45 that night at Madison Square
Garden.
Nobody saw them. The FBI started its investigation, of course, the very next morning. Went back multiple times to everybody who lived in the building. Nobody had heard anything. But the most remarkable thing about no one seeing them is the fact that the street from the Delaware County Courthouse, a guard station inside the glass front door of that courthouse, and it was staffed 24 hours a day. They knew this. So they figured out that there was no way that they could avoid being seen, that at any time they entered or left, that the guard standing there might see them. That in fact, coming out the door, well lit inside and outside, each of them carrying two large suitcases and putting them in trunks of cars, that there was a guard standing there looking at that scene. He was I know from reading the investigation, he was interviewed multiple times and didn't recall seeing anything unusual.
I found, by the way, and maybe you tell us in the book, I just didn't see it, that you can go on the Internet archives and read a lot of this material that the FBI wrote up about the investigation, a lot of the files.
The Medberg investigation.
The 33,000 pages or whatever that you that investigation of the break-in.
There are parts of it that they're by the FBI. I think.
It's an independent group called the Internet Archives. You could get on and read. The reason I wanted to find that one, and you have a picture of it here in the book where it says COINTELPRO, which seems to be one of the two big findings of all this. Tell us about COINTELPRO.
Yes. Of all the files that they found, there many of them revealed specific actions that the FBI engaged in. But probably the one that had the strongest impact was one that at the time it was impossible to tell that it was so important. It was a simple routing slip, a cover on a file of Barron's. The article was advice to college administrators about the need to get better control of protesters on campus, anti-war protesters. And the routing slip in big letters at the top said COINTELPRO, which stood for Counterintelligence Program, but we didn't know that, those of us who saw it at that time. And the FBI was watching for whether that file would emerge. And they knew that it had emerged because I wrote about what it was attached to. I didn't use the term COINTELPRO, but they knew what it was attached to. And it stirred quite a bit of action in the office the day that the story appeared, that they decided that they might have to take some action, because for the first time, this term, which turned out to be the name of most vicious operations, most powerful operations against dissidents, they knew that it was for the first time. And so at first he sent a memo out saying, this is now out there, it's not been reported on, so we have to be even more secure in how we operate this. But then I think it was 2 weeks later that he sent word to all of the offices saying, this program no longer has this name. That's been interpreted sometimes as saying that he ended COINTELPRO at that time. But actually what happened was that he simply removed the name so that if anybody inquired about it, as they did a few years later, they would say that program doesn't exist. But in fact, such actions did continue.
Betty Metzger on Q&A on C-SPAN Radio. Her book, The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI.
How big was the FBI when at that time when J. Edgar Hoover was running it?
I can't tell you the number of the agents.
But there are 200 agents working on trying to find out.
There were 200 agents working on this file. I mean, working on the investigation. Do you want me to talk about how we found out what COINTELPRO was?
Yes. Yeah, go ahead. I want to read something from your book after this.
Okay.
About some of the other things that the FBI was doing.
We only found out about COINTELPRO and what it was because of Carl Stern, NBC reporter who covered Justice Department. A little more than a year after the burglary, Carl was in the House Judiciary Committee office and saw that routing slip on someone's desk. And he read it and he noticed handwriting at the bottom where the agent in media is instructed to have agents give that article to university professors and to send it with anonymous letters to unfriendly university professors. And that piqued Carl's interest, and he said, what's the FBI doing something like that? And so under the Freedom of Information Act of 1966, that no one had ever been successful in using with the FBI, Carl applied to get the files in which Hoover had started COINTELPRO. He was just asking what it was and what the purpose was. His case took quite a long time because all the channels kept refusing to provide it. And finally, he did actually sue, and a judge ordered them to make that file available to Carl. And it was then, not until December 1973, that we learned about COINTELPRO and that it was this massive operation that was designed to do action against dissidents. Dirty tricks, harassment.
Video more from that New York Times short documentary they have on their website. People can watch the whole thing, but it'll give people a chance to see Carl Stern. Is he still alive?
Yes, he is.
And how did you talk to him for the book?
Yes, I did.
Okay, let's watch this and people can be reminded of what Carl Stern looked like.
Secret FBI memos made public today show that the late J. Edgar Hoover ordered a nationwide campaign to disrupt the activities of the New Left without telling any of his superiors about it. Many of the techniques were clearly illegal. Burglaries, forged blackmail letters, and threats of violence were used.
The FBI initially defended its actions.
The government would have been derelict in its duty had it not taken measures to protect the fabric of our society.
You talk a lot about Clarence Kelly, who was the follow-up FBI director after J. Edgar Hoover. But on Carl Stern, what is he doing today?
He's retired. He was such a crucial building block. I mean, I really see what happened back then as a series of crucial building blocks that finally led to massive change in the FBI at that time.
How much time did you spend on writing this book?
A very long time. But in the early 1990s, when I was still a professor and still an administrator at San Francisco State, and so I wasn't able to spend very, very much time on it. But for the 10 years prior to publication, I was spending nearly full time on it. My intention was to write a book that would, yes, tell the story of the burglary and of the people and their motivations. How in the world was it possible for people to make a decision to do something that could have sent them to prison for years? But I wanted to do more than that. I knew that it had an impact, but even I didn't really understand the full depth of the impact. So I wanted to spend a lot of time doing the research that it showed.
There are a lot of little sidebar stories, and one of them... And it's not that important to the overall story, except that John Raines and Bonnie Raines stayed in a pool house of the Shrivers here in town. And then you also talk about a car ride in which Michael Novak, who at the time was a liberal and now he's a conservative, was in the car. What is all that about?
Well, the summer, the Shrivers had hired John Raines to organize a conference at the Bioethics Center that they had just established at Georgetown University, and which continues to operate. But this was going to be the premier event, and so John was in charge of organizing a series of panels and very interesting speakers. That summer, Shriver and John were in the back seat of the car, as you described, and they were driving along talking about various things related to the conference. And all of a sudden, Sergeant Shriver turned to John and said, "I think you had something to do with that thing up in Media." John, as he describes it, was and said, "I that." And Shriver said, "I think you do." And John decided to leave it at that. This was not a discussion one wanted to pursue.
The chapter that I wanted to read a little bit, just because it's chapter 19, and it's called Crude and Cruel. Just the first paragraph. "Some operations carried out by the secret FBI were crude." These are your words. "Others were cruel and life-threatening. Anti-war activists, oranges, were injected with powerful laxatives. Agents hired prostitutes known to have venereal disease to infect campus anti-war leaders. Prostitutes were hired to trap leaders of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. Some plots were designed to destroy specific individuals and institutions, providing an apartment diagram that guided a Chicago police shooter to Fred's bed so Black Panther Fred Hampton could be killed, taunting the Reverend, this is another thing, taunting Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. to commit suicide. Look at this for a moment from somebody watching that says, well, I'm glad that J. Edgar Hoover was doing all these things because those people were against our effort in Vietnam, and I'm a patriot, and that Vietnam effort was something that our president wanted to do and backed up by the Congress. Why shouldn't he do all these things?
Well, I think that most people would not believe that an FBI or any law enforcement agency should be going about stopping expression of opinions, and that's really what we're talking about here in most instances, where J. Edgar Hoover was going after subversives rather than lawbreakers, but where he had a very expansive definition of subversive. Now, it's interesting, though, to realize that one of the impacts of his massive effort of focusing so much on subversives was that it defeated his competence in law enforcement to go after the things that Americans would expect the agency to be going after. For instance, despite all of the surveillance that was taking place and the dirty tricks operations where people were, informers were inside movements and doing damage to people, despite all of that, we never had that led to the stopping of any bombings that were planned, so that the law enforcement that was needed was damaged by this focus that was meant to stop movements and to destroy individuals.
Betty Medz, C-SPAN Radio, her book, The Burglary.
I want to show a piece of video with John Raines again from this event that we covered in Philadelphia, because he shows how, even to this day, how frustrated he is with the system. And I wanted to ask if you saw him react this way when you knew him personally. Let's watch this.
There are thousands and thousands of jobs depending upon us continuing to be afraid, really thinking we have to have thousands of people out there protecting us. We give each other the gift of safety every time we walk out of the door in the morning. We are the ones who provide a safe environment for all of us. I'm not downplaying terrorism. I'm just saying there's some kind of strange ideology, that gasoline of fear. Fear. You got to be afraid. Look out. You need us. You need us. Don't ask us questions. No, we can't answer those questions. It's all national security. Be afraid. Be afraid. Well, look out.
Is that the real John Ray?
Well, that's quite a long interview, but I won't do it all. But as you can see, nothing's changed. In fact, it's gotten worse. COINTELPRO was put in during the Vietnam War. Even though she mentions all this dirty tricks against the anti-war people, and of course even Martin Luther King and so forth, they were working equally hard against people on the so-called right and the Klan and so forth, and National Socialists and so forth. So, and it continues right down to today. We know in the 80s, I forget what year it was, I think it was after the hearings by Congressman, forget his name, but anyhow, the Attorney General under Carter installed the Leavy guidelines to rein in these people. But behind the scenes, the FBI started working with certain people in local law enforcement. We're talking about big police departments, L.A., New York, you know, San Francisco. And they recruited like one or two of the high brass out of each of these departments to run LEIU, law enforcement. I forget all the words, but anyhow, they set up computers in private buildings, garages and so forth, that were owned by these cops, private cops. And so the FBI continued right along and continued with the program, telling the public, of course, that it didn't exist. It was the Frank Church Committee that started putting the brakes on all this stuff. So they were even circumventing it, even after the Attorney General of the United States slapped their hands and said, you can't do this. They continued to do it, even though the Levy guidelines said no. And since I was quite active during that period, I know, because they were harassing friends of mine and going on their job sites and causing them to lose their jobs and so forth. Because all one of these agents has to do is go to your employer and just start asking almost no incriminating questions about you, and it scares the hell out of the employer, and he fires you, you know. And the FBI has done that for decades, and they've been quite successful in destroying people's income. Now, this is a short clip about the island of Puerto Rico, which you realize is split in two with the Dominican Republic and Haiti on the other side. And they do control immigration pretty closely as far as the Haitians coming over into the Dominican Republic, but just like in this country, they use them for cheap labor, and so they do allow too many to get through. And so this was a short clip that I listened to last evening, or the wee hours, I guess it was. See if
it wouldn't be good.
But and tickets to Miami or New York. And tickets to Miami or New York, where family members await. Almost no one stays in Puerto Rico. Meanwhile, the Dominican migrants, who lack the Haitians' protected status, can't just zip off to the States. Many try. Flights to the mainland are considered domestic, so Dominican migrants just need a fake ID to get on a plane. But it's risky. The majority choose to remain in Puerto Rico. Journalist Carmelo Ruiz says the island completely relies on the Dominican community to function.
I mean, it's the same dynamic with immigrants in the United States. They do a lot of the worst work, and if they left all of a sudden, who's going to fix my car? Who's going to mow the lawn? Who's going to work in agriculture? Who's going to do construction? Who's going to do this? I don't know what would happen. It probably wouldn't be good.
But immigration in Puerto Rico doesn't seem to stir up as much controversy as on the mainland. Here's Jeffrey Quinones from U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Feel about undocumented Dominicans living there.
In Puerto Rico, illegal immigration, it's not necessarily an issue of public concern. There's no sense that there's a conflict about their presence in the country.
He thinks it's because Puerto Ricans and Dominicans share a similar culture, food, music, language. Keldis Polo, the owner of a discount clothing shop in San Juan, agrees. The presence of the Dominicans just isn't a big deal.
En todos los pueblos, en todas las razas étnicas, siempre va a haber personas que son racistas, otras no. Pero realmente no se ve eso.
Everywhere you'll find a few people who are racist, he says. You don't really see much of that here. You see it more in the States. Still, others I spoke to paint a more nuanced picture. Dominicans are the butts of a lot of jokes, and you might hear Puerto Ricans complaining about Dominicans moving into the neighborhood. And with no legal recourse to turn to, labor abuses are common. Domestic worker Altagracia Pablo says employers sometimes try to take advantage of her and try to make her do more work than she's paid for. That kind of unfair treatment can make her pine for home. But overall, she says, life in Puerto Rico has been good to her.
Y en verdad, mi sueño no es irme para Santo Domingo. Mi sueño es jurar por esta bandera de Estados Unidos.
My dream isn't to go back to the Dominican Republic, she says. It's to pledge allegiance to this flag, to the United States.
Y en verdad, Puerto Rico, I love you.
Truthfully, she says, Puerto Rico, I love you. For Latino USA, I'm Marlon Bishop.
Anyhow, I got that a little screwed up there because it's Puerto Rico is separate, and it's there's two different problems. You got Haiti and the Dominican Republic all on one big island. The Haitian being the blackest part of the island and the most downtrodden, poor. And they keep infiltrating over into the Dominican Republic. But as they get into the Dominican Republic, then they start getting across. There's not, it's not too far across the channel there. The they call it the Mona Pass. And to get into Puerto Rico, of course, Puerto Rico is a lot smaller than the Dominican Republic and Haiti. And so anyhow, it's just like a domino effect, of which we should never have been involved incorporating Puerto Rico as a U.S. protectorate or whatever you want to call it. It's all ridiculous. Now these are just beachheads for more and more Negroids to get into the United States. And it's easy for them to come in with a passport or even temporary visa or a student visa or anything like that. Once they're in, they never go home. And this is all tolerated to make the buck. It's about the buck, about the money. Always follow the money. Now I want to play a little bit of a clip I picked up off the airwaves, showing you how sports and big influential sports coaches and stuff used the sports to screw up the South as far as culture and so forth. Now this, I'm getting some interference where it's cutting on and off, and I can't do anything about that. I may be able to figure it out on another broadcast, but not today. So I know it's a little irritating, but I think you can make out what's going on here.
College sports, and explores the history of that topic in America. Historians Brian Ballow, Ed Ayers, and Peter Onuf host the show. Here's Ed.
When they think of college football, think about the South. They think about the SEC and schools like LSU and Auburn and Tennessee, where I proudly went, and the reigning national champions, the Alabama Crimson Tide. And while Alabama has certainly seen some incredible college football, that history has not gone unblemished. Alabama was one of the last schools to integrate its football team. Now, the university first admitted black students in 1963, but it took 7 years for a black student to actually play in a football game for Alabama. The story of how this happened is complicated, so I'm going to bring in one of our producers, Eric Mennel, to help tell the story.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Eric.
Thanks, guys. So, legendary coach, Paul Bear Bryant. And the story goes that in the early and mid-1960s, Bear Bryant led his football team, his all-white football team, to 3 national championships. A lot of people feel like they were actually snubbed for a 4th.
So they're good.
Yeah, they're really good.
But Bear Bryant sees the ground shifting, and by the end of the decade, the Alabama Crimson Tide just can't compete with teams that are utilizing black talent. He is ready to integrate the football team because he wants to win, but he's not sure that the state of Alabama is ready. So Bryant, as the story goes to the head coach of the USC Trojans, that's USC is in Southern California, and asks him if his team will come to Tuscaloosa in 1970 to play the first integrated game at Alabama.
Yeah, and the story goes that this is all part of Bryant's calculation. To this point, no black player has ever played in Tuscaloosa, not even for a visiting team. But Bryant knows about one player at USC, one player who is just going to stomp all over Alabama. Sam Bam Cunningham.
Sam Bam Cunningham?
Yeah. Sam Cunningham is a running back, and he's an African American. Bryant wants to show his fans that black players can help them win games. So on September 12th, 1970, USC comes to Sam Bam Cunningham. He puts on a show.
He was just having a field day.
That's Andrew Purnell. He graduated from the University of Alabama just a couple of months before the Sam Cunningham game. And looking back on the footage of the game, it's just so blatantly obvious how much stronger Cunningham is than the Alabama defense. I mean, he is pounding through the linemen.
Running at will.
And he does one of those moves where you put your hand on the other guy's face and just sort of push him away.
Nobody could catch him or stop him.
And so Sam the Bam Cunningham, the first black player to play in Alabama, runs for 135 yards and two touchdowns, leaving the Trojans over the Crimson Tide.
But what's really amazing is what happens. Bear Bryant walks over to the USC locker room and asks Cunningham to come with him. He brings Cunningham back to the Alabama locker room, stands him up in front of the Alabama players, and says, "Gentlemen, this is what a football player looks like."
And then, the next year, Alabama offers its first football scholarship to an African American. Into almost all of the documentaries about integrating college football at Alabama, you know, Sam Cunningham actually co-wrote a book about this game called Turning the Tide, the Game That Changed the South. You know, one of the assistant coaches at Alabama at the time said that Sam Cunningham did more to integrate Alabama in 60 minutes than Martin Luther King did in 20 years. It's a pretty amazing story.
Well, yeah.
But there's a little problem, guys. You want to tell them, Eric?
Yeah, sure. The problem is that this idea that Sam Cunningham came from California and broke the color barrier in Alabama football, well, it's... So the story is the one who helped integrate Alabama in 1970. But remember Andrew Purnell, the Alabama graduate from earlier? He's an African American, and, well...
It was 67 through part of 68, and I played football at the University of Alabama.
Spring practice for the Crimson Tide of Alabama, and everything seems to be just like any previous year, but it's not. Head coach Bear Bryant spurs on his Southeastern Conference champs, and among the players, pass receiver Andrew Purnell, one of three Negroes on the squad.
I was on the intramural football team, and we had a game over by the practice field where the Tide practiced. And they had these privacy covers over the fence to keep people from looking in. But some of my friends who were on the team, the intramural team, we went over and we looked through the gaps in the privacy covers. And after a while of looking, I said, "I can do that." I think I said it out loud.
And so Andrew Purnell decides to walk on for the University of Alabama football team along with four other African Americans.
And those other guys were Doc Roan.
He was a guard from Montgomery, I think it was.
Melvin Leverett.
He played. He was a fullback.
Arthur Dunning.
He was a running back.
And Jerome Tucker.
He was a halfback.
And Andrew Purnell, he was a 5'8", 150-pound wide receiver. Now, you have to understand, none of these guys were all Americans. They were walk-ons. They played some high school ball, but they weren't standouts. Now, most mediocre players just have to prove themselves as athletes. But these five men had to prove themselves as people.
The day we went over, we walked into the locker room, and we know that locker rooms are very noisy, a bunch of guys, football players especially. And it was noisy until we walked in that morning, and nobody said a word. And we began practice soon after that.
What were your interactions with the players like?
The players were distant, and you know, it's kind of like I did not exist. There was no camaraderie for the most part as being a member of the team. There was one guy in particular, I remember he came to me in private, and he said, "So y'all just as good as we are. If my daddy knew I said that, he'd kill me."
So some of the white players have actually said they were to treat their black teammates the same way they would treat their white teammates. So Bryant had pretty firm control over the locker room. But the thing he didn't have control over was, you know, the rest of the state of Alabama. And just a warning, this next little bit has some pretty intense language. So if that bothers you, you may just want to turn down your radio for a minute.
That year, it was 67, I got four hate letters. I called them fan mail at the time, and it said, "Dear nigger, haul your black ass north. Color stars not wanted at Alabama."
Did you ever get a chance to play in a game?
There was once I got all excited, called my parents, and told them I might get a chance to play. I think we were going to play South Carolina that week. Coaches came to me. They were asking me my shoe size, and they asked me about my grades. They were fine. So, and that just died down. And that was very disappointing. That was one of the most disappointing moments I thought I had.
It was less than a year before the other four guys left the team. It had been a year and a half of practices for Andrew when he had a meeting with one of his coaches.
Assistant head coach Sam Bailey called me into his office one day, and he said that the university had found out, like they discovered, that I was on an academic scholarship.
So basically, every football team in the Southeastern Conference had a quota on the number of scholarship players they could have on the roster. Andrew was receiving a scholarship from the local church, so technically this put Alabama over its limit.
So he gave me a choice. He said I could stay on the team, but I would have to give up the scholarship.
Andrew says his family only made between $3,400 and $3,800. It wasn't much of a choice. He left the team.
Some of the players that came after me were invited to come, and they were treated as guests. I was not. I was treated as an intruder, uninvited guest. So that made all the difference.
And so, 3 years later, Sam Bam Cunningham comes to town, while Andrew Purnell and his four black teammates become a footnote in the Alabama legacy.
Guys, I've just got to ask, if that's the case, how did the Sam Bam Cunningham story become the only one that we know today?
You know, I had the same question, Brian, so I went ahead and asked David Matthews. Now, he's now the president of the Kettering Foundation, but in 1969 and for most of the 70s, he was president of the University of Alabama.
Paul Bryant was a master at public relations and actually created this myth, I think, to give him some defenses against the people who were, in those days, very outspoken in their opposition to integration. And so he wanted to give the Alabama folks something they could say that would just take that issue off the board.
So this is in many ways he was protecting against the right flank.
Exactly.
He see this as a way of sort of giving white Alabamians a chance to kind of accept this without suggesting that they'd knuckled under to this outside agitator,
yeah,
Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
Sam Cunningham gave Paul Bryant a little bit of cover, so a year later he could bring his own black players onto the field.
Yeah, but what really gets me is the fact that 40 years later, this Sam is still the one that people are telling.
And why do you think that is, Eric?
Well, in the legacy of Alabama football, Andrew Purnell was really just small potatoes. But Bear Bryant?
You have to understand football in the South, football at the University of Alabama. Bear Bryant was like a god. He could have been governor if he had wanted to. And they still, you know, hold him in such high esteem. There's so many things at the university named after him.
You know, Bear Bryant is a legend. He is perceived at Alabama the way Joe Paterno was perceived at Penn State for so long. But when you start to look at him through the lens of Andrew Purnell's story, you start to realize that although Bryant treated the African-American walk-ons with tremendous respect, it still took him 8 years to put a black football player in an actual game.
He was a great football coach. Could have been a great man. He had the power to do much more than what he did if he had spoken out.
The one who could have acted but didn't? Remember our heroes.
Well, there you go. So you want to know who did more to integrate the South and get the race mixing going? Martin Luther King? No, I don't think so. I think it was a white man by the name of Paul Bear Bryant, a coach there in Alabama. And I've always said they've used sports as much as possible to cause integration and race mixing. And you can see all the time all these white girls out there, cheerleaders and all that stuff, and pretty soon they're going out with all these niggers. In fact, probably that's all they're going out with nowadays. But when you hear the right wing yapping, well, it's just the Jews. It's just the Jews. No, our problem is white traitors. Our problem is white traitors, the biggest problem. And almost in every instance where you saw big breakthroughs with race mixing, there was a white man or a white woman behind it. Remember that. problem with this satellite reception is that I've had real good luck with this Gerald portable satellite receiver, but just lately it started cutting out every couple of seconds, 3 or 4 seconds intervals, and interfering with the files. However, I can go on the internet and go to the original show, but it takes a lot of time, and when we're doing a daily show, it makes it very difficult to do. So I'll continue to try to iron out this problem.
Mario Savio's speech from 1964 has gotten a lot of attention recently because of the Occupy Wall Street protests. It's a pretty subversive speech, advocating mass civil disobedience to shut down the machine. But it's legal. If I was here at UCLA and said the same thing, the California or the U.S. government couldn't arrest me and prosecute me for saying it. But that hasn't always been so. And in a very real way, I owe that right to another speech, this one by the Ku Klux Klan. In 1964, the same year as Savio's speech at Berkeley, a Klan leader in Ohio named Clarence Brandenburg invited a local TV news crew to film a rally. A dozen Klan members are on a farm, wearing red hoods and burning a cross. Brandenburg gives a speech about their plans for a march on Washington, D.C. Quote, "We're not a revengeant organization," he says, "but if our president, our Congress, our Supreme Court continues to suppress the white Caucasian race, it's possible that there might have to be some revengeance taken." Revengeance, by the way, is not a real word, and it's not really clear whether these guys were scary or looked pretty pathetic and delusional. It would help to see the original TV news footage, but more on that later. The state of Ohio prosecuted Brandenburg for advocating violence or unlawful methods of terrorism as a means of accomplishing political reform. He appealed his conviction, and the Supreme Court of the United States agreed with him.
Number 492, Clarence Brandenburg, appellant versus Ohio.
At one point during the oral argument, the attorney for the state of Ohio tried to make a point.
If I were to go, and I use this as an extreme statement, but if I were to run down Harlem, shall we say, and say, bury the Negro, send them back to black Africa.
You wouldn't last that long.
Probably so, Your Honor.
He was interrupted by Justice Thurgood Marshall, the court's first African-American justice. Later, the attorney for Brandenburg responded.
When Mr. Kirshner suggested that I could run down through Harlem saying, kill the Negroes, and Justice Marshall responded, you wouldn't last very long. The Justice Marshall, who is safe at the moment because the venue is in Washington, D.C., but in Ohio, could be indicted for suggesting a violent reaction by the Negro community. This is the state of the invasion under this statute into the First Amendment rights.
The court in Brandenburg versus Ohio reversed Brandenburg's conviction and set a high bar for when the government can prohibit the advocacy of lawless action.
Under the Brandenburg test, which is the currently existing First Amendment test,
that's Professor Eugene Bollock, who teaches and writes about First Amendment law at UCLA.
The advocacy of crime in general, it's only punishable if it is directed to and likely to produce imminent criminal conduct. So if you're standing there and you're calling people to do something right away, if it's criminal, that's a crime. But if you just say in general, it's a good idea to violate the law in this, that, and the other way, and you ought to be doing that sometime, that is constitutionally protected today under Brandenburg.
So speech like this,
and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the leaders,
is protected.
Upon all the apparatus, and
but it hasn't always been that way.
Hello?
Brandenburg, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, is okay.
This is Robert Goldstein, professor of law at UCLA.
The modern First Amendment has its beginnings in anti-war, anti-war speech. We have a volunteer army and enormous firepower these days, but World War I was a war fought with soldiers in trenches, and it required a all-out effort, both at home and abroad. That is, it required soldiers, and it required a mass support. Any deviation from that kind of support was thought to be unpatriotic and undermine the war effort. So prosecutors were quite willing to prosecute and convict those who opposed the war.
One such protester was named Charles.
So Schenck called on individuals to petition their representatives and to use their vote to oppose the war, but
apparently the newspapers during World War I published the names of the young men being conscripted to fight overseas. And so this guy Charles Schenck, the Secretary General of the Socialist Party in Philadelphia, mailed them pamphlets which argued that the draft was a violation of the 13th Amendment's prohibition against slavery and was a, quote, monstrous wrong, and urged them to not submit to intimidation. Long live the Constitution of the United States. He was prosecuted under the Espionage Act of 1917.
Made it, had a variety of provisions, but the provision relevant here prohibited the obstruction of the recruitment effort.
Schenck was convicted and appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. wrote the court's opinion. Between college and law school to fight in the Civil War. Unfortunately for Charles Schenck, he had enlisted.
Right there. Okay. All right. Am I going whatever?
Whatever you want.
Now I get the butterfly.
Here's what he wrote in the court's opinion.
The most stringent protection of free speech would not protect a man in falsely shouting fire in a theater and causing a panic. The question in every case is whether the words used are used in such circumstances and are of such a nature as to create a clear and present danger that they will bring about the substantive evils that Congress has a right to prevent. Thank you.
All right. The clear and present danger is that the nation is at war and that the particular speech is delivered in circumstances that are likely to be persuasive and clear and present danger is that the nation is at war and that the particular speech is delivered in circumstances that are likely to be persuasive and undermine the war effort in some way, whether that the speech in Schenck is because it's delivered to potential recruits, or in Abrams because it's delivered to persons who might strike.
In the Abrams case, four, quote, long-haired anarchists from Russia, as the New York World described them at the time, dropped leaflets from the roof of a munitions factory, making bombs and bullets to strike.
Threat to the war effort, or because of a very popular political candidate in Debs, being persuasive that the war is oppressive and unfair to those who are fighting it.
A socialist candidate for president who was convicted for 10 years for making an anti-war speech. President Harding later
World War is what we call the first Red Scare in the history business.
Okay, cool.
Check it again. Check levels.
Yeah, let's just do it one more time.
Okay, my name is Tobias Higbee. I'm an associate professor of history at the UCLA.
I stopped by the department to get a better idea of what was going on at the time. There is some disagreement over what to call it. Red Scares, I guess.
Yeah,
and led to
I don't
a lot
like
of
the term Red Scare.
Okay.
Red Scare again suggested it was an unsound scare. It was perfectly sound. We saw that communist groups managed to take over countries and produce untold misery there in revolution and violence and civil war. So whatever was wrong when restricting the speech, it wasn't that people were just pointlessly scared. They were reasonably worried about that speech.
They were worried because these foundational issues about society, things we take for granted today, even after the Great Recession, were being questioned.
You know, you have to think about it as a time of incredible stress for the country. And the question on everybody's mind really was whether or not you could have democracy and this new system of industrialization, of industrial capitalism. Would democracy and capitalism work together? Or would you need some sort of new system? Would you have to modify capitalism, or would you modify democracy?
A law professor at the time, the first scholar to really study the First Amendment, said it best in the Harvard Law Review. Instead of falsely shouting fire in a theater, as Holmes put it, how about somebody who gets up in the theater between acts and informs the audience that the few or locked? Before Brandenburg versus Ohio, the clear and present danger test was what the courts would use to decide if that person could be punished, sent to jail, for speaking. So what exactly is the test?
Well, we don't know it exactly, because the court never specifically defined it and applied it in different ways. So it said speech is protected unless it creates a clear and present danger of certain harms that the government is empowered to prevent. But how clear it has to be, how present it has to be, is it present in the sense of immediate or present in the sense of the danger is of some harm that might happen not that long from now, whether there's a separate intent requirement, that was never clear.
And it opened the door to legislatures, where the majority rules, to declare some speech dangerous. In other words, to automatically pose, by law, a clear and present danger. The Espionage Act of 1917 prohibited obstruction of military recruitment, but
the obstruction part was not a speech statute. It was a prosecutor who came forward and said, this speech obstructs. But the cases that the court got after the war were speech crime cases, where the legislature described certain speech as being dangerous speech.
These laws made it illegal to advocate a change in industrial ownership by means of sabotage, terrorism, etc. Pretty vague stuff. One of the more well-known prosecutions was of Charlotte Whitney, a daughter of a prominent family in California, who went from being a charity worker to a member of the Communist Party. She was convicted, and the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed. The governor of California eventually pardoned her.
The problem isn't just that the clear and present danger test was used to restrict speech. The problem is that sometimes it was used to restrict speech, sometimes to protect speech. It came in different flavors. So if a court today was to say the right test is clear and present danger, it's not so much that it's announcing the test that will reach the wrong results. It's announcing a test that we don't know what results it will reach. So if you want a test that's protective, you want one that's not just one that could be used to protect speech if interpreted the right way, but that is defined in a crisp enough way that once it sets a precedent, presumably future courts will be using it to protect speech.
And that brings us to the masses.
The masses case, and that was a case in which the Postmaster General exercised his authority also under the Espionage Act to close the mails to magazines that similarly obstructed the war effort. This was the Masses, a very respectable left-wing magazine.
Sure, I know the Masses.
What do you know about it?
I don't know about the case, actually. So the Masses comes out of the socialist movement, and it comes out of New York City, and it's edited by important socialist intellectuals. And it's kind of a paper of cultural radicalism as well as just political radicalism.
Into today, anything?
More radical than The Nation, for sure. More radical than In These Times, or I'm trying to think,
no,
first sort of like
magazine.
Against the Current or something. But it would be, it's
don't
hard
really
to,
know what he's talking about.
You would have to think about it as like Time Magazine.
I know Time Magazine.
You know, the People's World or something like that. So there's
no idea.
They would have very, very high-end intellectuals like Upton Sinclair and Lincoln Steffens. And
try to imagine the U.S. Postal Service today banning a political magazine. But at the time, these magazines were a new and persuasive form of media.
This is a period when magazines are transitioning into, you know, glossy covers and printing photographs, and so it's not just text anymore. It's more interesting and engaging. And
potentially subversive. The masses printed anti-war material, including a series of cartoons.
That a today could run in any newspaper.
Like one using a tape measure to measure a draftee for a It had poems written by jailed war protesters, stuff like that. But here's the thing. The federal judge who heard the case found in favor of the masses and prevented or enjoined the postmaster from banning the magazine from the mail. His name was Judge Learned Hand.
In the masses case, as a district judge, he proposed the incitement test.
Danger test. Hand's test, called the incitement test, would ask,
does the speech incite an individual to action, to take illegal action? Is it a trigger of action?
I thought that coming. Okay. I prefer a test based upon the nature of the utterance itself. If, taken in its setting, the effect upon the hearers is only to counsel them to violate the law, it is unconditionally illegal. By counsel, I mean to persuade them that their interest or duty lies in violating the law. As to other utterances, it appears to me that regardless of their tendency, they should be permitted.
So for him, the court ought to focus on the nature of the words used. Words that suggest that it is in your interest or your duty to do something, not to believe something, but to do something, he said, is an incitement. At that point, the speech would cross a line for Hand from participating in what people should believe and how they should exercise their right to vote to inciting an action that would violate a law that was the product of prior public discourse. So
yeah, it sounds like a real subtle difference from the clear and present danger test, something only lawyers could come up with.
That's right. It's not always easy to apply these standards, but the difference in focus is this. Hand said, rather than trying to predict future harm, and rather than trying to assess all the circumstances, especially because judges live in a rarefied world in which they may believe that speech is more dangerous than it is, I'd rather have a judge actually look at the text of the words, evaluate the words themselves.
When Learned Hand looked at the masses, he saw condemnation of the war and objectors, but no incitement, so he ruled in his favor. But the Court of Appeals shot down his incitement test. They reversed his opinion, writing, quote, "This court does not agree that such is the law." Hand's biographer, Mass's case, was painfully disappointing for Hand.
Well, that's it for now, along with our interruptions there and the intermittent, but we'll try to get by that as time goes on. Incidentally, someone that a lot of you may know, Marty Cox from California, who I've known ever since he was a teenager, has now, he's had heart trouble for some time, and I got a call from him. He's in the hospital, and his heart efficiency is down to 20%, and that's pretty bad, and he doesn't sound like he's going to be getting a new heart or anything like that. Marty was a skinhead band leader. He had his own band, went all over the place, went to Europe and everything else. And so we're just hoping he gets better. Okay. Well, that's it for today. We'll be back tomorrow, Tuesday. And until then, 14:05. I have nothing to say.
It's 5 o'clock and one more working day is finally at an end. I hurry from my job and start the car, fight the traffic once again. Driving down the interstate, my tension eases as the traffic thins. And I leave my worries far behind and wonder what the in crowd might be doing. Farther down the road, a pretty woman's waiting with a drink for me. There's a lot of woman there, and pretty soon that's where I'm gonna be. I'm the only one that's missing. I'm the one the in crowd's waiting for. And I drive around the back and leave the car. Then I open up the door. And there's...